Hey everyone, and welcome to Booked on KD&K. I'm Lucas Turner, filling in today for Gavin Dahl. Today I'm speaking with one of, if not my favorite author, Cory Doctorow, a futurist and co-editor of popular web blog Boing Boing, an MIT Media Lab research associate and award-winning and best-selling author, and a freedom and technology activist. Thanks for joining me on KD&K Community Radio this afternoon.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure. Although I'll say, I don't know if that was in my bio, but I'm definitely not a futurist. I think anyone who claims they can predict the future is smoking their own product.
Okay, interesting. So let's talk about this book, Radicalized, your latest book. What initially kicked off the writing of these four novellas that make up this book?
I call it my Trump derangement syndrome book. I, like lots of people, have been struggling to deal with just the incredible tempo of news stories over the last couple of years. Some of that, I think, is deliberate. I think that the big tech services use engagement algorithms that just kind of blitz us with news faster than we can absorb it, in part because it lets you kind of recycle the news. Because if it's not clear from day to day whether you're following a news story or the same story, you might click, even though you already saw it yesterday, right? So the new wrinkle is to whatever extent possible, kind of sensationalized and disguised. So there's no kind of narrative coherence. And the problem with that lack of narrative coherence is that it just makes you feel like just stuff is happening. And stuff is happening in a way that is impossible to predict and impossible to counter or brace yourself for. And, you know, as a writer, the thing that I do when I'm confronted with a lack of narrative coherence is I start to impose narrative coherence. So I wrote these kind of for my own mental health, and they came out, I think, well. My publisher was, like, incredibly excited by them. They basically don't do short story collections, but they were like, for these ones, we'll definitely do a short story collection. And moreover, we're going to treat it like a novel. And so, you know, they sent me out on tour and paid me a big advance and did all the things that you would normally not see for a short story collection. I was very gratified by it. And also by the reception it's had since it came out in March.
So in the first story of the book, Unauthorized Bread, you explore the immigrant experience in the United States, but the major theme actually seems to be corporations controlling people through software. So I was just curious as to how and why did you decide to pair those two things specifically?
Well, you know, we tend to focus when we think about technology and its consequences quite naturally on what technology does. But really, if you want to understand whether technology will make your life better or worse, you need to focus on who technology does it for and who technology does it to. You know, there's a famous now essay by Douglas Rushkoff where he went to this investment banker conference and they were obsessing over what they would do when the world ended and how they would survive it. And one of their big problems was that they were going to have all these armed guards and they were going to have lockers full of food. But once money wasn't worth anything, the armed guards might shoot them and take their food. And so they hit on the solution of having, like, biometric locks with proof of life so that the guards would have to keep them alive, otherwise they'd starve to death. And, you know, like, speaking my capacity as a dystopian science fiction writer, that's a pretty dystopian idea. But also speaking as someone who's occasionally gone on a diet and wished that I could put a lock on the fridge when, you know, there was stuff in there that I wasn't supposed to eat, I'm here to tell you that the difference between, you know, something that serves you and something that locks you in perpetual food bondage is just who's got their finger on the button, right? Like who can make the technology go? So Unauthorized Bread, it's a story about people in refugee housing where all the appliances are designed to extract as much money as possible from them. The toaster will only toast authorized bread, and the dishwasher only washes authorized dishes, and so on. And it's an attempt to kind of explore what I call the bad technology adoption curve, where if you have a terrible, awful idea for how to use technology to make people's lives worse, you have to start by trying it out on people whose complaints don't get a hearing. So usually these bad ideas, they start with people who are like refugees or prisoners or blue-collar workers or just immigrants or people on parole or kids or mental patients. But as those people kind of grind the roughest edges off of the technology and help to normalize the technology, it works its way up to the curve until we've all got it, which is why, like, if 20 years ago you were eating your dinner under the you know, unblinking gaze of a closed-circuit camera, it was probably because you were in a supermax prison, and now it's because you were dumb enough to buy, like, an Amazon or Apple home automation system.
So a common thread between all of these characters in the stories and in many of your stories, is this fact that they're technically savvy to differing degrees, but this is especially prevalent with the main character in Unauthorized Bread. So I guess in the context of that story, what would you say are the implications of people growing up in this society that's so permeated by technology, and thus more people or a higher percentage of people are technically capable, such as the main character in Unauthorized Bread?
So it's largely lost to the mist of history these days, but the early STEM education movement was not about like maximizing GDP by producing, you know, engineers who were ready to go join the tech accelerator. It was about self-defense, right? If you are going to understand, push back on, and demand better from the technology that is increasingly regulating your conduct and your life, you really need to be able to speak knowledgeably about it, to understand its technical contours, to know when someone tells you that something is impossible, whether they're snowing you or whether it actually is impossible. You know, this is true both of the rank and file everyday individual, but also, you know, increasingly lawmakers, as Aaron Swartz said before he died in 2015, I think, or 2013, it is no longer acceptable for a lawmaker not to understand technology.
Do you foresee a clash then between, I guess, what you would call digital natives? I guess it seems like that clash is already happening between people who have this sort of native understanding of technology from growing up in it and these people who are governing that have no idea and maybe don't even use email. I guess that's what you're getting at.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I don't like the digital native framing because it assigns to children the blame for the natural mistakes that all kids make. So digital native is a bit of a problematic label. What I do think we're headed for a collision between is people who care about what the evidence says and the very small number of people with a very large amount of money who have turned our truth-seeking exercises, like our regulatory proceedings and our other exercises, into auctions, where instead of trying to figure out what's true or not, we try to figure out what's most profitable for the people who have the most money to spend on buying the outcome that makes the most sense to them. You know, where I'm from in Canada, we elected this guy, Justin Trudeau, as prime minister, whose, you know, signal virtues were his incredible pecs and his great hair, which, you know, not incidentally are also the signal virtues of Vladimir Putin. And it turns out that they no better serve Justin Trudeau than they serve Vladimir Putin, because as soon as he took office, he bailed out the canceled Trans-Canada pipeline, bought it with Canadian tax dollars, and said no country on earth is going to leave trillions of dollars worth of oil on the ground. And the thing is, if Canada actually digs up and allows to be burned the filthy oil from Alberta's tar sands, the entire planet will boil in its own juices, and it will no longer be habitable by human beings. And the reason that Justin Trudeau had this road to Damascus conversion from someone who wanted to defend the environment to someone who is literally willing to kill every man, woman, and child alive today and to come was that someone bought him, right? Someone bought his government. There was too much money at stake.
Is it the future of climate change and the future of what impact that will have that motivated your writing of the last story in this book, Mask of the Red Death?
So Mask of the Red Death, it's a story about preppers dying in a bunker. And it's you know, if you know the Edgar Allan Poe story I stole the title from, you'll know that it's kind of a piece with a long history of rich people deciding that they don't have a shared destiny with everyone else, and particularly like not a shared microbial destiny. Mm-hmm. And that things like public health can be left to one side and be turned into a kind of Darwinian winnowing function where the world tells you who is worthy and who is not by killing the unworthy with infectious diseases. And the problem is that you can't shoot germs, right? I don't care how great your bunker is, and how heavily armed you are, and how fervently you wish to emerge from a world in which all the useless people have been killed off to live out a kind of Frazetta painting future where your thumb drives full of bitcoins and your mercenaries with their AR-15s allow you to amass a harem and rule border town. But the reality is that if a disaster strikes, and it will because complex systems have failure modes that are hard to predict, if a disaster strikes, the way that we'll get the machine running again is by everyone rushing towards the disaster to put out the fire and restart the machines, not by everyone cowering in a bunker, wetting their beds, and waiting for, you know, hapless Morlocks to go and get the machinery of the world running again so that their social betters from the Eloi class can emerge and revert them to the bottom of the pyramid where they were destined to be.
So in the story Model Minority, we follow this Superman-like figure, and I think we see a lot of superhero-type stories in popular culture today, but often those stories, it's this powerful hero, and they're fighting some powerful villain. But in this story, you chose to take a powerful hero and pit them against actual societal issues, and you show that those types of heroes are not equipped to address those issues at all.
Yeah, we've had a 40-year ideological project to convince people that all of our problems have unitary individual causes and unitary individual solutions, right? That if you're worried about climate change, you should be recycling harder and maybe becoming a vegetarian, as opposed to lobbying for societal changes. Now, if you live in almost anywhere in America, with the exception of a couple of cities with advanced public transit, chances are your biggest contribution to climate change are the four wheels on the board that you use to get to work every morning. And you can't individually build your own public transit system. You know, no one, not even Elon Musk, gets to dig their own subway, right? And so these problems, they have societal answers. Now, the superhero story is the story of the unitary individual solving social problems. And in particular, Superman is that story. So Superman was created by these two Jewish kids in Brooklyn. One of them was from Toronto. Joe Schuster, my parents in Toronto, used to live on Joe Schuster Way. And these kids were watching with horror the rise of Nazism across the Atlantic, and watching the indifference of the U.S., thanks in large part to political campaigns by racist billionaires like Henry Ford and Charles Lindbergh, who advocated against the U.S. embroiling itself in a war to, quote, save Jews. And so the Siegel and Schuster imagined that they could build a golem, right, an all-powerful man who would go and interpose his physical body between fascism and its victims. And they imagined that individual action would head off this bad outcome. But when you actually look at what happened in World War II, you see that although there were many acts of individual heroism, and I have a great uncle who was a partisan fighter in Poland who lost an arm in the war, that all of that individual heroism didn't matter except to the extent that it was part of a collective project. And in fact, defeating Nazism was the single largest collective project in the history of the world. Now, you know, I am as prone to anyone else as wishing for individual heroes to come and save us simple solutions to complex problems. And I wrote that story, which is about Superman intervening in a fictionalized version of the fatal beating of Eric Garner, the man who was choked to death by New York Police Department officers on the street corner for selling loose cigarettes that had not been taxed. And I wrote that story after reading Matt Taibbi's history of the murder of Eric Garner, a book called I Can't Breathe. And as I read that book, I kept thinking, if only someone had stepped in to save Eric Garner's life. But Eric Garner, in addition to being an individual who suffered the most lethal of consequences for racism, was also symbolic of a much wider problem. That's why his death means so much. And that problem is systemic, not individual. And it has causes that are very low level and widespread and dispersed. And that if individuals are to solve them, we are to solve them by working together, by forming the coalitions that allow us to address these vast systemic problems.
So I want to sort of focus in on something that is sort of touched on in that story, which is, and, you know, tell me if I'm wrong or if I'm not describing this correctly, but one of the things that sort of gets mentioned is the maybe not AI, but sort of automation-based policing, where they're using algorithms to do policing. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious as to, I guess, the real-world examples of that. But I also, you know, to harken back to one of the things that I learned in Little Brother is this false positive paradox. So does that, mm-hmm. is that something that you get concerned about a lot? And Do you ever just like feel like you bang your head into the wall whenever these automated policing or automated crime or terrorism detection systems are sort of put into place in reality?
Well, yeah, I certainly do. And I think that, you know, it is a very urgent issue addressing this conundrum of automated systems and algorithmic bias and discrimination, because although the systems that algorithms replace, the systems of fallible human judgment, are also prone to bias. And in fact, the bias in algorithmic systems comes from human bias. Like if you create a predictive policing system where you say, okay, here's all the crime data from last year, tell me where the crime will be this year. What you're actually doing is not predicting where the crime will be, you're predicting where the police will look for crime, right? So you're when you say, tell me where the crime was last year, what you're really saying is, tell me where the police looked for crime last year, because the police only detect crime where they look for it. If you only stop black people and ask them to turn out their pockets, you will find some knives and some guns and some drugs, as well as a lot of pockets full of things that are perfectly lawful. But if you ask an algorithm, what are the correlates of knives and guns and drugs, they will tell you it's the black people, right? And so then the algorithm, the model that it generates, sends you off and tells you to go and look for black people and make them empty their pockets. And this is where it gets really dangerous, because now that you've eliminated whatever human judgment might have led people away from bias, right? Once the algorithm only tells you to look in black people's pockets for contraband, that is the only place where you will find it. And so in the second year of the experiment, you go from a system that is very biased to a system that's entirely biased. And this has been borne out. A group called the Human Rights Data Analysis Group, which is a nonprofit that mostly works on human rights issues, mostly war crimes tribunals, and using statistics to analyze the full scope of atrocities in war zones and acts of genocide for things like the Court in The Hague and Truth and Reconciliation Commissions. They decided to do a rigorous experiment in the bias found in machine learning systems for predictive policing. So they took the policing data from Oakland, California, and they fed it into a predictive policing algorithm from Predpol, a company that was started by a professor from the University of California system. And they compared its predictions about where the drugs would be in the following year to an NIH study that was done in the following year, a public health study that gathered statistics on where drugs were actually used in Oakland. And drugs in Oakland are used by pretty much everyone. And if there is a place where drug use is a little more concentrated, it's around the university. It's a nice, affluent neighborhood. Mm-hmm. But the predictive policing algorithm predicted that all the drugs would be in a black neighborhood. And you just need to superimpose these two maps to see how machine bias emerges. Now, machine bias and algorithmic policing were part of the reason that Eric Garner was killed. So the way that the New York Police Department conducted its policing was by using a so-called data-driven model. And that data-driven model required that the police conduct a certain number of stops every day. But if you go out and you stop affluent white people who can sue you every day, it becomes very expensive, slow, and difficult for the cops. So if you only stop and frisk poor people, you can get a lot done. You can fill in all of those reports that you need to fill in to make your quota. And that's exactly what the NYPD were doing, and it's exactly why they kept stopping and arresting Eric Garner for this penny ante stuff that a nice affluent white guy in a suit would have never faced.
So we still haven't talked about radicalized, which is mm-hmm. obviously the one that the book is named after. So could you just give us a summary of what that story is about?
Yeah, sure. It's a story that kind of answers a question that I've often been plagued with since I moved from Canada to the UK to the US, which is, how is it that in America you have lots and lots of entitled, angry white men who own guns, who, when they get angry, routinely shoot their wives and brown people at mosques, but who, when an insurance executive dooms the people that they love most in the world to die slow, lingering, painful, horrible, needless deaths by denying them care, even though they've paid for it, those angry, affluent white guys don't go and shoot healthcare executives. It's kind of a mystery, really, mm-hmm. when you think about it. Like, how is it that healthcare executives aren't all in witness protection programs? Now, I'm not, like, advocating that we should shoot them all. I'm just wondering how it is that they've escaped that fate, since it seems that people who commit much less grievous sins are at a pretty high risk of being shot up by an angry man. And so this is a story about angry men who find themselves on a support message board for people whose loved ones are dying horribly of cancer, who have been denied care by their insurers, who go from supporting one another to egging one another on, to radicalizing one another. And it's modeled in part on the story of the incel movement. Incels are the men who call themselves involuntarily celibate. It's a kind of misogynist rape cult that has a very weird origin story. It was founded by a young Canadian queer woman who was struggling with the very real traumatic experience of not having physical love in her life. It's a very sad place to be denied that physical love. And so she did what so many of us have done when we're hurting and when we have a problem. She created a place online to talk about it. But what she realized over time was that her support message board had a cultural difference to other kinds of support message boards, like the support message boards for people who are struggling with alcoholism, in that the people who solve their problems in the incel world didn't hang around, right? Once you found a partner, you left the incel message board world and took yourself off to live a better life. And so what this meant is that the elder states people of the incel world, and really the elder states men, were all people whose problems ran so deep, who were so broken, that they couldn't ever find love. And unlike a traditional support message board where when you say, I took a drink today and I feel terrible, the people who've been around the longest are like, you know what, you can do this. I was where you were and it got better, not worse. In the incel world, the people who are there to tell you about what happened before are there to tell you that it only ever gets worse and that this is as good as it gets, and from now on, your pain will only increase. And that creates this kind of horrible, radicalized movement where now incels have become routine mass murderers who leave behind these long kind of eugenic manifestos about how as beta males they have been dealt this unfair hand and will never find sexual satisfaction because the alpha men are hoarding all the women. And funny and tragic if it wasn't also terrifying because they keep killing people in great numbers. And, this points to a different model for radicalization than the one that we usually think about. When we talk about radicalization, we usually talk about it as though it were a contagion. Right, you get too close to someone with a bad idea, and that bad idea rubs off on you. And, this is something we see a lot in the war on terror, that people who are known associates of people who have terroristic tendencies become themselves subject to intense scrutiny and sometimes legal reprisals. But when you actually look at who commits atrocities, you find that what they have in common is not that they were presented with compelling arguments that turn them into true believers. It's that they were vulnerable to what is otherwise not very convincing arguments, and that vulnerability came from the trauma that they had survived. And so, if we are going to address trauma instead of contagion, we need to move our response to radicalization from this quarantine model, mm-hmm. where we take people who have espoused a radical belief and lock them away, and we need to move to one where we actually try to address the trauma that people are living through, right? Right now, our response to radicalization, it's like the terrible apology, right? The terrible apology goes, I'm really sorry you're angry at me. Please try being less angry at me. And our response to radicalization is, I'm really sorry you were traumatized. Please try not to be quite so traumatized by it. And so radicalized tries to dig into what happens when we incur this debt, right? This policy debt, this emotional debt, this trauma debt, that leaves behind people who, for one reason or another, are in a position where they see no reason to live, are in a position where they see the world is holding no promise for them, and allow that to drive them into these radical, unsustainable, and dangerous places for us, and what a legitimate response would look like.
Is there anything else that you want to say to wrap this up? Do you have any, action steps that people can take if they read your work and they feel like they want to do something about any of these issues?
Well, there are a bunch of organizations that work on this. And one of the things that I'm really excited about is that we are seeing a convergence of people who understand that causes that they thought they were committed to are in fact effects of the deeper problem of wealth and industry concentration. There are people who are worried about big tech and its concentration, and they should be. They should be worried that, you know, five or six tech executives, if they decide that they don't like you or the message you have, can just make you disappear from the discourse. And, you know, I think a lot of people cheered when Alex Jones was effectively kicked off the internet. And I'm no fan of his, but it should be a wake-up call, because if you think that the only people the tech executives are going to wield that power against is Alex Jones, you haven't been paying attention as trans activists and as Black Lives Matter activists and as sex worker activists were kicked off the internet by the same decisions from the same handful of tech executives. And so what that means is that we now have common cause with people who care about big tech, but also about people who are wrestling fans. Because 30 years ago, there were more than 20 wrestling leagues. Now there's just one. And that wrestling league is owned by this Trump donor billionaire, Vince McMahon. And Vince McMahon, because he's the only man standing, was able to reclassify all of the wrestlers as contractors. He took away their health insurance. And now GoFundMe is full of dying 50-year-old professional wrestlers begging for money to defray their medical expenses. And so the people who care about big tech are on the same side as the people who care about whether or not their favorite wrestler is going to die of a preventable illness because Vince McMahon took away their health insurance. And those people have common cause with the screenwriters who've just gone out on strike, because there's only three talent agencies left here in Hollywood, and they're all owned by private equity funds that have started to do new kinds of deals where they accept less money for the writers they represent if they can get more money for the agencies and its shareholders. And they have common cause with anyone who makes or wears glasses, because every eyewear brand you've ever heard of is owned by one company, an Italian private equity-backed company called Luxottica, who also own every eyewear retailer you've ever heard of, and the largest eyewear insurer, and the largest lab that makes glasses and contact lenses. And so all of us are poised for this ecology moment, where the fact that I care about cyber policy and you care about wrestlers and he cares about the plight of movie studios and that person cares about what's going on with the energy companies being consolidated and someone else cares about big pharma, all of us are poised to realize that we're fighting the same fight. And it's a fight against oligarchy and monopoly, and it's a fight in favor of pluralism and egalitarianism. And, you know, whether you get involved with the Electronic Frontier Foundation or the Sierra Club or Black Lives Matter, we're all on the same side. We are all fighting for a world in which we go where the evidence leads us, not where the maximal benefit to shareholders is realized.
Cory Doctorow, New York Times bestselling author and author of recent collection of four novellas, Radicalized. Thank you so much for joining me, Cory.
Oh, thank you very much. I had a lovely time.